Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If it's Monday, it must be time for our weekly reporter roundtable, just in time for another legislative recess. And the trial gets underway in Cleveland and the alleged conspiracy to pump cash into two Republican campaigns and to cover up the crime. And will State Treasurer Josh Mandel testify? Joining us in the studio is Chrissy Thompson of the Cincinnati Inquirer. Welcome back, Chrissy.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. Laura, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Jackie Borchardt of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Welcome to the show, Jackie.
Glad to be here.
Okay, so before we get to all of that, let's talk about predictions by Ohio's Lieutenant Governor and also Insurance Commissioner, Mary Taylor. She said last week that insurance premiums will go up as much as 15% next year under the Affordable Care Act. And Steve Koff of the Plain Dealer took a closer look at the numbers. Well, what did he find, Jackie?
Well, basically, Steve, my colleague, requested the records that the insurance companies actually, the rates that they filed, that their averages. And what he found is that that 13 to 15% includes some outliers, including some smaller companies that have never served Ohioans before. And when you break it out, the large companies that represent most Ohioans that are buying insurance on the marketplace, actually, their rates are going up in the single digits, nothing more than 9%.
So what do we mean? There's some that are included in it that aren't actually. Does that mean that people can't buy from these companies or that they haven't sold anything yet in Ohio?
They can buy. It's okay. The latter. It's that they don't have anything to compare it to. And so they're, you know, their rates are much higher, and they're being lumped in with these larger firms, your Medical Mutual, your Anthem Blue Shield, Blue Cross. And that alone raised that average 13 to 15% number.
So when you say single digit numbers, what are we talking about? That's Steve Koff.
I think it was anywhere from 3 to 6 to 9%.
Which isn't bad.
Which isn't bad.
Not at all. I mean, it's always going up, right, Laura?
Right, and I think that my colleague Randy Tucker at the Dayton Daily News did a similar story and found that the problem with Mary Taylor's numbers is that they weren't weighted so that big insurers like Medical Mutual of Ohio were included in the study, but they were lumped in with everybody else, but they represent a much larger share of people who have insurance. It's no secret that Mary Taylor does not like Obamacare. She has been a very harsh critic in Ohio and even nationally of the program. But the fact is that, you know, the rates aren't going to go up as much as she said. And for years, even before we had Obamacare, people were experiencing pretty significant rate increases in their health care insurance.
Even people who pay through the company they work for.
Right, right. The companies and the employees have been absorbing pretty hefty hits year after year.
Well, and it's important to note that, you know, we keep saying Obamacare, but these are rates that are set by private insurers. And it's up to the Department of Insurance still has to approve these rates. You know, these are not set in stone. And the numbers that she was using and that, you know, Steve looked at too, were averages. They're not your exact year-over-year dollar amounts.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And my reporters roundtable is at work today, as usual, on Monday morning. If you have a question or comment about something happening in state government, politics, something in the news, want to get their take on it, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So she took this as an opportunity, once again, to blame the president, blame Obamacare.
That's certainly what it looks like.
Yeah, that's right. And so some of the justification that she gave was, we have some new insurers coming into Ohio. How do you rate insurers that have a 0% market share? But she could have broken those out into another category. And by doing that, then the numbers would have told a very different story. So, you know, given her, you know, distaste for Obamacare, it certainly merits some stories, which our colleagues have done here. So,
okay. The Suarez trial starts today. Both State Treasurer Josh Mandel and U.S. Representative Jim Renacci of Wadsworth have been subpoenaed by the defense to testify in this federal case. Jackie Borchardt, again, sources have told the Dispatch that the politicians would soon file petitions to have those subpoenas quashed. This has to do with Mandel's U.S. Senate campaign against Sherrod Brown in 2012. What's the deal?
Well, actually, you know, Suarez is the one who's on trial, and
right.
he allegedly members of his company contributed about, I think, $200,000 between the two candidates for their
to the Mandel and
right.
Renacci
was running for Congress and Mandel was running for Senate. And essentially, allegedly, he told his instructed his employees and their families to give these contributions. And there's also tied into that a mix of political favors that Suarez sought with the two politicians, most notably asking them to kind of lobby on his behalf for a case in California where California Attorney General was taking issue with some of his questionable business practices, which he runs a mail, among other things, many other things. He runs a mail order type business selling products that Laura knows the list better than me, but like bread that can cure cancer.
Oh,
that
was an old one. He's, you know, Suarez for maybe 40 years or so, he's made a lot of money by selling a lot of questionable products to Americans across, you know, from coast to coast. And, you know, he's a big Republican donor, and he was having problems with, I think, 8 district attorneys in California that they were suing him over making false claims on his products. And so he was enlisting Jim Renacci and Josh Mandel, and he appealed to other politicians as well to help out. John Hughes had made a phone call to the Attorney General, Kamala Harris, out there on his behalf. And anyway, none of that really gave him much traction. He ended up settling the lawsuit earlier this year and paid, I think, a $1.8 million fine and made promises not to do, you know, X, Y, and Z. But anyway, in the meantime, in doing this, you know, he raised $105,000 for Mandel's campaign and $100,000 for Renacci. And he did so using straw donors, and that's illegal. You can't give money in the name of somebody. I can't give money to Chrissy and say, Chrissy, give it to Ann's campaign.
That's right.
And I'll pay you back later or whatever.
Right, because what was supposed to happen is he instructs these employees to give $5,000 to Josh Mandel, and then he will pay them back later. So
right.
that they don't actually have to, you know.
It's not their actual cost.
Correct.
It's just
correct.
In their name.
Correct.
And it also appeared that they were going to use corporate money to make the reimbursements. Mm. And then when they found out that the feds might be investigating, then there was like this big cover up to try to make it look like it was a profit sharing deal for these employees and blah, blah, blah. And that led to the feds applying an obstruction of justice charge and tampering with witnesses and I think tampering with documents. So, you know, Suarez is facing some really serious charges, and his the other guy who was charged, Mike Gregorio, who was the Suarez Corporation, yeah. SCI, he was the CFO of the company. And he took a plea deal last week or the week before and agreed to testify against Suarez. And so that was a huge blow for Ben Suarez.
Once again, it's about the cover-up more than the crime itself.
It's about both.
Both. Okay.
Yeah.
And this is the defense that has subpoenaed Mandel, and Renacci is mm-hmm. how you pronounce his name. So some people have said that what could these guys possibly do for the defense? They've said they're going to cooperate with prosecutors.
That's right. I mean, the Mandel's office even said
we'd be more damaging.
Yeah, we would hurt the defense, we would think. So, Renacci and Mandel have both returned the money. And I certainly want to distance themselves
right.
from this as much as possible.
But they didn't return the money until after it was published in
right.
newspapers around Ohio.
That's
that
right.
there was this big investigation.
It did
investigation.
Take some time. Yeah, right. indeed.
Well, the question is, did they know about it?
And they have not been charged with anything.
Right.
They haven't
right
been charged with anything. The question, you know, it's unclear whether or not anybody in Mandel's campaign staff knew about what was going on. It might be interesting to see if, like, his finance guy gets subpoenaed at some point. You know, this is going to be a tough case because I think the feds have 11 reluctant witnesses that they had to offer immunity to.
Hmm.
All of these employees in Suarez's shop and their spouses, they were all going to take the fifth, and now they're going to probably be dragged to the witness stand.
And meanwhile, back at the ranch, at least, well, both of them are up for re-election now, right?
Yes.
Josh Mandel to the state treasurer's office. And Is it Renacci?
Renacci.
Renacci. Renacci. Okay. All right.
You said Renacci.
All the options.
Pick your pronunciation. They're both up for re-election. And they're saying, now, they've also said that they're just looking for records. They aren't actually subpoenaing.
I haven't seen the subpoena, so I don't know what it says or doesn't say. But yeah, the thing is, Mandel's in a pretty tough election. He's going up against State Representative Connie Pillich from Cincinnati, mm-hmm. and she's also a veteran, as he is, and I think she's going to wage a pretty tough campaign.
Yeah, it's interesting. Mandel, you know, not super super well liked after the Senate campaign. People know his name and around the state now, and in some ways not positively. But he has a big fundraising advantage and is a fantastic fundraiser. And I mean, here we are talking about his fundraising. So, but be that as it may,
coincidence.
You know, Connie Pillich is not going to be able to close that gap. But she has a reputation of being just an insanely good campaigner, very very hard worker, and you know. The last time we saw polls, which is not very often for that kind of a race, it was pretty close. So we'll see what happens.
On this trial, I mean, even though Josh Mandel is not being charged and as of right now is not testifying in the case, Democrats are going to use it to show that, you know, he's been involved in this federal investigation, that, you know, he didn't return the money right away. I mean, there's any number of things that they can point at in this whole instance.
Oh, absolutely. Can
Heaven
you imagine
politics, right?
If Mandel is testifying, you know, what happens with those news stories and those, I mean, goodness sakes.
And then in addition to the Suarez campaign, we have another leftover scandal from the Boyce administration in the treasurer's office. Mm-hmm. The deputy treasurer, Amir Ahmed,
right.
He is still on the run in Pakistan.
Oh, he's still on the run.
Well, he stopped running. He's in the jail.
Okay,
the
yeah.
he might be running in circles in his jail cell.
In place, right?
Right? Yeah. He's jogging in place. From what I understand, he's supposed to go to court sometime in the next week or two. And they're going to charge him with some local stuff about carrying false passport
in Pakistan.
In Pakistan.
Uh-huh.
And it's unclear whether or not he is going to be released and repatriated to the U.S. to face justice
and
here.
And what are his alleged crimes? What he's
it's not
charged?
Alleged. He actually pleaded guilty to bribery and conspiracy. He steered contract work to a high school buddy who made $3.2 million in commissions off of it and then kicked back $523,000 to Amir Ahmed. And then two of his co-conspirators, Nuria Alu and Joe Schiavarelli. Mm-hmm. So,
dueling scandals.
We have dueling scandals,
right? And Mandel's office, you know, when they took over, started cooperating with this investigation, which had just gotten underway days before they took office. So, in some ways, you know. They view themselves as having cleaned up the treasurer's office, but so these competing scandals, I mean, I imagine we'll keep hearing about them all year long with the election.
Yeah, the subpoena from the feds on the Amir Ahmed case, like, got dropped on Kevin Boyce's desk, or on his general counsel's desk, about a week before the Mandel folks took over. So then they basically handed it off and said,
yeah.
"Okay, it's yours."
They, you know, there's those late night take, you know, transitions when the new team comes into
right.
the office and
right.
they say, okay, here's these are the files you need type of a thing. And she handed it to his deputy and said,
here you
and
go.
I got this also. So have fun.
Politics.
Yeah.
The gift keeps on giving. Okay, we will continue our conversation with our reporters roundtable. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. It is time for our weekly reporter roundtable. If you have a question or comment, want to have a question about something going on in state government, current events, want to get their take on it, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, Chrissy Thompson of the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Jackie Borchardt of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. David in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hi. I have an important issue that gets skipped over a lot, and I think it was addressed with the new requirements for clean energy for Ohio, but then the Ohio legislature was just bought off by the First Energy and is trying to throw back the clean energy requirements. I think Ohio has some of the worst air quality in the country. This is not just windmills. This is life and death for a lot of people.
So what's your question?
My question is how are they getting this? Why isn't this a bigger campaign issue? I would like to see this being more of brought forward and, seen more as something that Ohio should do along with other Midwestern states.
Okay. Ohio Governor John Kasich, David, we'll get to that right now. He has said that he will sign the bill freezing renewable energy and energy efficiency mandates for utilities in Ohio. Chrissy Thompson, your story asked whether an energy study also mandated by the bill would answer the key question. But before we move on to that, let's talk about the politics of this. Is this an issue that voters are paying enough attention to make it a campaign issue for all the legislators up for re-election and so on?
I think there's a couple of ways to look at this, and I'll bring up one. You're going to hear probably this week a lot about Governor Kasich signing this bill to put a freeze on these standards.
And a two-year freeze.
That's right. And one reason that I don't think that this can be much of a big campaign issue for the governor's race, for instance, is that there are lots of questions being asked about, Ann Fitzgerald has raised the possibility that this could be permanent, you know. So Ed Fitzgerald's telling us where he stands, right? If in 2 years the legislature were to, make permanent cuts, he's trying to send some message that he would oppose those in some way. But also, unfortunately for Ed Fitzgerald, so would Governor Kasich, I believe, because quite a bit in the past several months, attempts to actually cut those standards now instead of putting a freeze on them, he threatened to veto many times. Mm-hmm. Last week, leading up to when that bill passed, we would hear if there's anything extreme, the governor's going to veto it. So they, and so they view this as a compromise. And in this particular election, there are differences between the candidates for sure. But, I think that Governor Kasich is more moderate on this issue than Democrats would want to communicate.
We've talked about the freezes a lot on this show particularly, but we've also talked about this too, and that is the energy efficiency standards that the utilities have to offer energy efficiencies to their customers. And that's not as well, I think, understood necessarily what that means.
Well, the people like to say the cheapest energy is the energy you don't use. Mm-hmm. And the 2008 law requires the utilities to help customers reduce their use by, I think, 22% by 2025. That's pretty big. And I know that, for example, I think Columbia Gas and AEP here locally have had, free energy audits. And then, you can help defray the cost of getting your home insulated, hauling away old appliances, right, et cetera, et cetera. And I think Peter Stoutberg?
Stoutberg.
Mm-hmm. Stoutberg. He said on the House floor last week that there's only so much you can. There's only so many old refrigerators you can haul off and new light bulbs you can screw in before you end up losing your energy efficiency stuff. I know that the Manufacturers Association has been in favor of or opposed to Senate Bill 315 because they are so much in favor of these energy efficiency programs. I mean, their members are saving lots of money by by big savings, big efficiency efforts.
The Chamber of Commerce was for 310. The Manufacturers Association was against it.
Right. It's really it's really divided the business community.
Yes.
Right. And the you know, most of the green energy proponents who are the loudest opponents of this effort are operators of businesses in Ohio. Everybody has some sort of money involved in this on both sides, frankly.
And the proponents of 310 say that it will save money for manufacturers. The opponents of it say it will cost money.
That's right.
So they're
both
coming
sides,
to very different conclusions.
That's right.
Kind of like a la Mary.
Mary Taylor.
I think it's a little easier to look at those numbers we were talking about earlier in the Mary Taylor situation and just, you know, do some averages and say, well, no, that's not right. The problem with these studies is that everybody shows you all their data and they come to absolutely opposite conclusions. So in one case, at least in the next 2 years, we will find out whether rates really go up or down. However, it you know, it just depends on what your utility as a ratepayer decides to do. It depends on a lot of things, and it's a very complicated issue.
It was only 2008 that they approved the legislation that created the standards in the first place. And back then, Governor Strickland, a Democrat, was in the governor's office, but the legislature was still controlled by Republicans, right?
Mm-hmm.
What changed?
Well, the supporters of 310 say that you know, that the natural gas prices have plummeted, that we have the we can go out and frack a lot of oil and gas out of the
we don't need to worry about saving energy.
Yeah, essentially, it's like less of a pressing issue.
And the economy has changed. You know, we were at a peak at that point in time and are now on a slow climb back up from a deep recession. So.
But really, the renewable energies law that passed in 2008 had a very long view in the political world is almost unheard of, all the way out to 2025.
These days, yeah.
You know, this was sort of a long haul effort for Ohio to contribute less to greenhouse gases and to make things more efficient and improve the climate for renewable energy businesses. I mean, there's a lot of businesses that are now complaining that, you know, the rug's gotten pulled out from under them, that they invested all this money, they got set up, and then boom. Now they have no idea whether or not these standards are going to be put back into place after the freeze is over or not.
Mm-hmm. So doesn't the Chamber of Commerce represent them too?
It's true. You know, the Chamber, a large voice in the Chamber of Commerce is small business people,
right,
who pay dues to be in this lobbying group, and they don't have their own lobbyists, right? So sometimes when you see the chamber differ from manufacturers on issues, it is because of the voice of the small business person.
And the NFIB Ohio, which
National
is the
Federation.
National Federation of Independent Businesses, which is really small business, they were also in favor of it.
In favor of 310.
Right. So they were on the same side as the chamber.
Okay. So there's supposed to be a study group. What are they going to study? What are we going to learn?
Well, I think they're going to study the same stuff they've been studying
right
for the last 2 years.
I don't know how much more we're going to learn. And it's going to be a group of lawmakers.
That's right.
Bipartisan group of lawmakers, which is exactly the same scenario that's been reviewing this for more than 6 months.
I mean, they've been reviewing it since last year.
Almost.
So a year to a year and a half. And the mandate, or the frozen mandate, is a 2-year freeze, right? So they have to make a recommendation to the legislature, and the legislature will have to act within that 2-year period. So essentially, they have the exact same amount of time as they've just had to do the exact same thing, listen to the exact same people come forward and give likely the exact same testimony.
We might now hear from the utilities, because that was the one voice that was missing in this whole, in the public debate,
it?
At
I mean,
least,
were
at the State House.
Represented by the
First
Energy, none of them testified in the committee
meetings. They're supportive of 310, aren't they?
One would think so, but we don't know because they never stepped forward publicly.
Yeah, you heard a lot about First Energy being behind it. We talked in Cincinnati to our utility, Duke, and they basically said, in not so many words, we're staying out of this, no comment type of a thing.
Hard to believe.
Were
they
really lobbying for this? It's hard to believe that they were totally staying out of it. But
yeah.
The utilities have a small army of lobbyists. They're very well represented in the lobbying community.
I think. So the question is, Republicans were under a you hear Democrats often, because they don't control any of the committees in the legislature, say, why don't we bring this person in to testify, or this group, or this group? And they have no, you know.
They can't compel them to come and testify.
I compel you.
Yeah. Actually, I think some of the legislative hearings do have, they do have subpoena
power.
Right.
Huh.
Right. But
very rarely used, though.
The majority would have to sign off on that, though, for instance, because I've heard, I think Ron Gerberry is always trying to subpoena Houston into to talk about voting rights.
Secretary of State John
Houston. Exactly.
Yeah.
So they can complain about the utilities not testifying and this being really all utility driven all they want. But unless the Republicans, decide that they're going to bring them in, it's not going to happen.
King of the Mountain, you're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about state government, politics, current events. If you have a question or comment for our panel of State House reporters, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So, the Ohio General Assembly is at that time already, goes on summer break after this week.
Mm-hmm.
That is until its lame duck session after the November elections. Could they come back this fall before November elections?
I think they could. I'm not sure what they
sometimes
have scheduled.
Do.
Sometimes they come back for a couple of cleanup items.
They don't have anything scheduled right now, I don't believe. Is that right, Jackie?
Yeah. Okay.
But I think it also depends on what is left hanging at the end of this week. And if they are serious about addressing severance tax issues, that might be one issue where they might need to come back a little early. But I don't think there's anything that I can think of that would be huge that they would need to come back.
The speaker made some vague comments about calling everyone back in time to get term limits on the ballot in the fall, but I really don't think that's going to happen. We pressed him on that a little bit more, and he kind of said, like, oh, you know me better than that, you know, type of a thing. So I don't.
And do we? We don't know. So what are they going to do this week? Why even be here in the first place? What's up?
Well, they've got to get these mid-biennium budget bills out.
Oh, those.
Yeah,
which
those.
That's what the governor calls his.
I just call him an off-year budget bill.
Off-year budget
because,
bill, yeah.
You know, it's not the big budget, but these are all things that have to deal with things that are in the state budget and then some. And that's kind of what the stage that they're in now is. Several of these bills, they split it into a dozen bills, and several of them have passed both chambers now, but one chamber, well, I guess in this case, the Senate has disagreed, or the House has disagreed with the Senate's changes. So
right.
Now they have to come together in small committees and decide what's going to stay in the bill, what's going to go. And then they have a vote on that compromise.
And that should be this week.
And that would be this week.
Yeah, probably Wednesday or Thursday.
So the severance tax, you thought, was one of the issues?
That's they're going to come back to that next in the lame duck.
Okay.
Yeah.
They're not
unless
pass
they
it out
unless
week.
They come back before the election, but that won't move anymore.
Okay. One of the issues that I've heard a lot about is red light cameras.
Yeah. So that bill was up for a vote last week in committee, and
it would ban municipalities from.
Essentially, it depends on the.
There's two bills. So there's the sites bill and the Bacon bill.
Correct. So the sites bill was up for a potential vote last week, and they held it. And we anticipate that they will not touch it until lame duck at this point. However, and the two bills that are up are, again, one that would require a municipality to put a police officer sitting at any light where they had a red light camera. The person wouldn't have to pull anybody over, but they would have to be sitting there in order to issue the tickets.
Well, that kind of renders the whole red light
thing.
But that's the point. I mean, it's banning them without outright banning them.
Right.
So it's actually kind of a smart way to get rid of them if you don't want to deal with the courts.
And the other bill would just regulate it, basically putting in rules that Columbus has across the state. Columbus says that they wouldn't have to change a thing under the other bill. But that bill appears to kind of have stalled. It's been introduced, but appears that the bulk of the...
Is that the Bacon bill?
That's correct. Yeah, Senator Bacon introduced that one.
What is the opposition to red light cameras? Is it still that they think that the municipalities are just using them to make money?
Well, I think there's two primary veins of opposition. One is that it's a cash grab by municipalities. The other is that, it's ticketing the car owner, not necessarily the driver, mm-hmm. and it's going through a civil procedure rather than a criminal procedure. And it's not being adjudicated through courts. It's like through an administrative panel. So there's some constitutional questions about whether or not red light cameras in Ohio, how they're doing it now, if that's okay.
There's no due process for if you get a ticket, there's no real way for you to challenge that ticket.
And one thing we haven't seen up here in Columbus, but two townships or a village and a township down in Cincinnati, we have, or maybe they're both villages, New Miami. I can't remember if that's a village or a township. And then also Elmwood Place down in Cincinnati, both of these municipalities. Elmwood Place is most famous for making, I think, $1.7 million off of speed cameras. In 6 months, their village has 2,000 people in it, and their entire budget is $1.2 million, I think. So they made enough in 6 months in tickets to more than cover their annual budget. And most of those people don't live in the village. They just commute through the village. So this has been struck down by a court and will be in the state Supreme Court in a week or two. But cases like that, where there's been alleged abuse, courts have stepped in, have caused a lot of this uproar about this isn't fair. People shouldn't be getting tickets this fast.
But then there's, there are other places that, are using the cameras at strategic intersections where they've had a lot of accidents and problems. And they're arguing, like Columbus and Dayton are arguing that the red light cameras have improved safety in those intersections. Mm-hmm. So there's a public an argument for public safety, but then when you hear about these little villages, then it makes it sound like more like big cash grab and that it's an abuse of the system.
And that's what Senator Bacon's bill was attempting to do, was to allow municipalities to still have the cameras but kind of avoid some of the abuses that they've been hearing about, that there would have to be some thought behind where these cameras are placed, and that cities would have to be more transparent about why the cameras are there and what what kind of results they're seeing from the cameras.
Yeah, it says they'd have to install signs at intersections where the cameras are located and at the city border, so they mm-hmm. give notice to the drivers, mm-hmm. conduct a safety study at intersections before installing the cameras, lengthen the yellow light times at least 1 second longer than the state minimum, and have a law enforcement officer review all violations captured by a camera.
And again, that's in the Bacon Columbus bill. Says that they do all of those things, so it wouldn't change Columbus's rules. Interestingly, I'll bring up Cincinnati within the city. Voters have voted a few years ago to ban all traffic cameras, so we're not allowed to have those down there.
They put it to a vote.
That's
of
right.
The people.
Indeed.
What an idea. We are talking about state government politics. It is a lame duck session. It is the last week before state lawmakers take a break for the summer. They probably won't be back until the lame duck session after the election in November. If you have a question or comment about something happening at this legislative level, something else that you think you'd like to get the take on of our panel, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to our weekly reporter roundtable on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Still with me in the studio, Chrissy Thompson of the Cincinnati Inquirer, Jackie Borchardt of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. Question or comment for our panel, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. A federal judge has halted executions in Ohio until mid-August. Once again, this has to do with the issue of dosages of drugs used when administering lethal injections. What's going on, Laura Bischoff?
Well, so in January, Dennis McGuire from Preble County was executed using a previously untested two-drug combo. It took 26 minutes for him to die. There's gasping and choking while he was unconscious. So now, then the state at the end of April, they said, well, we're going to use the same drug combo, but we're going to increase the dosages significantly, and we'll see how it goes. And federal judge Greg Frost ordered a halt until at least August 15th so that they could give some more thought to this. This also, after the McGuire case, Oklahoma had a botched execution using a lethal injection. The inmate ended up dying of a heart attack after they tried to, like, revive him. They tried to execute him, and then they tried to revive him.
They halted
him,
the execution, yeah.
Right.
Because he was waking up, wasn't he?
Right. Yeah, he was waking up. In other news, I guess Missouri, late last week, the Missouri Attorney General proposed establishing a state lab where the state could make their own execution drug combos. They're getting harder and harder to come by because the manufacturers of these drugs don't want them being used for
European manufacturers.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And then, you know, Tennessee, I guess, is looking at returning to the electric chair.
As an option.
As an option.
Yeah.
It used to be an option in Ohio until just maybe 8 years ago or so, and they retired Old Sparky in Ohio. Wyoming, I think, was looking at bringing back the firing squad, and Jackie used to work in the cowboy state.
I did. I know that lawmaker well, and he's working on a bill for next January. So
to bring back the firing squad.
Mm-hmm. Well, Utah, I believe, still does have that as an option.
As an option.
Meaning the
inmate gets to pick.
The inmate gets to pick, but nobody ever does pick that.
Well, which would you pick, Ann?
I don't know. I honestly don't
Jackie,
know.
Do you know the last time that someone was executed by firing squad?
I don't. I think, I don't know in Utah when it was. I don't.
It's a more popular option out west.
This is getting really complicated for states to carry out the death penalty. Who knew?
Well, Ohio used to do it by hanging, and then they switched to the electric chair because they thought it was more humane, and then they switched to lethal injection. Support for the death penalty is still pretty solid. It's about In Ohio, and also nationally, it's about 62%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you give poll respondents the choice between the death penalty and execution, or between execution or life without parole, then the support drops to about 40-40. It's less popular then.
Oh, people would prefer life without parole.
Right. Some of the death penalty supporters say, well, okay, instead of execution, I think maybe life without parole is adequate. But, you know, for a long time, people would get sentences to life in prison, and then they get out after 10 years.
Right.
And that led to a lot of truth in sentencing laws and changes in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how long Ohio's had life without parole as an option. It's been at least 10 years.
I was going to say since the mid-90s, but
that's
when all the three strikes and you're out laws came through. That
was
truth in sentencing.
Right. In 1996, they came in with Senate Bill 2, which was the truth in sentencing law.
All right. So they're going to put off till August. What are they going to find between now and then? Are they going to do guinea pigs experiments? I mean, what are they going to learn?
That's exactly my question. Is the judge says he wants to hear the arguments over our decision, the state's decision to use this enhanced cocktail.
They want to up the dosage.
Correct. I just don't know what more there is to find out. He certainly, as a judge, is entitled to hear these things and to do his best to enforce what he thinks is the law.
And meanwhile, back at the ranch, one of the condemned is asking if he can now donate a kidney. Is that it, to his mother?
Yeah, Ronald Phillips. But I think that's already been decided.
That's been settled.
He's not able.
I don't know. He
something.
Has more time
but
now.
But now he has more time.
He has renewed his request.
Right.
Yeah.
He's renewed his request.
Because he says the reason, I guess, the state gave was you don't have enough time to go through the surgery and recover before we put you to death.
Oh, that's right.
And he's like, well, I got more time now. So.
He's a young man in good health. And
and it has an ailing family members that he would like to help. I don't think he still only has an extra month. I don't know that that's really going to make a difference at this point. But
Rick in Grandview, you're on the air. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Ann, and your guests. Sorry, I'm rewinding a bit to Senate Bill
310. Yeah, the 310. Renewable energy freeze. Yes.
And also, every time I hear Kasich's name, my mind goes to the set of Mordor and the Eye of Sargon.
Oh.
But the man is notoriously opaque about his views. I think that's fair to say. And as far as his saying that he would veto something that was too harsh, what I'm thinking is that he's in a different position. I think it's pretty likely that he's got presidential aspirations. And he has to watch what kind of political trail he leaves, even on environmental issues. So he wouldn't want to look like he was too overboard in some situations. I'm sorry, I'm having a real hard time giving him the benefit of the doubt that he has some somewhat progressive thoughts about environmental issues.
So are you saying you think he said he will sign Senate Bill 310.
Yes, but I think one of your guests said he threatened to veto anything that was too harsh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You think that's why?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm just going to throw that out. It's nice to be positive about people. But
you compared him to Sauron, so
yeah.
I mean, your guest has a
that's just about as bad as it gets, Rick.
I'm working on something worse.
The eye of evil. Okay. All right. Thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, Chrissy.
He has a good point. Your caller has a good point in that. The compromise is in the eye of the beholder, and there have been a lot of Democrats saying this is no compromise. There's all sorts of other ways you can have a study without a freeze. That's the main argument that's thrown out when they say this is a compromise. But indeed, there was a movement, late last year, beginning of this year, to just go ahead and wipe off all of the energy mandates. And there are a great deal of the Republican delegation that there's a great deal of Republican delegation that would support that. So, whether or not this is a worthy compromise, I mean, that's definitely up for the voter to decide.
And it's not inconceivable that Governor Kasich is eyeing the presidency. He's certainly done it before, so.
Yeah, I think that's in the realm of possibility for sure. That he'll run in 2016,
right?
He at least tries it. At least,
I mean, his name is it's being thrown around in polls. It's coming up in the media, and if he wins re-election in Ohio by a good, healthy margin, I think he'd be well-positioned.
We have an email from Charlotte, switching gears drastically. She says, the last I heard, Ohio House Bill 351 will come up for hearings this week. This bill would forbid public hospitals in Ohio from providing abortions except for ectopic pregnancies or ectopic pregnancies. No provision is made for patients suffering from other life-threatening conditions. Those patients would have to be transferred to private hospitals. Will this bill come up?
I think it has a first hearing scheduled this week, which is with the sponsor, and that's usually it's customary that you would give a bill a first hearing. I don't know if it's got legs after that. I think it's I don't know. I haven't looked it up. But I think this is sponsored by Representative John Becker from Southwest Ohio.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and
oh,
John Becker bill.
John Becker has a lot of bills, so that's why
he's smiling
over here.
But, he introduced this a while ago, and it's only now having a first hearing right before a break. I really don't think it's going to be one of the bills that they bring up in the lame duck that they rush to get passed. I think it's a little maybe too extreme even for this pro-life house.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, Becker's bills don't have a good track record of passing, so I don't
Anyone
think.
Can introduce a bill.
Mm-hmm. He's introduced the most of anybody.
So. A tradition that was only started in the 90s, I might add. It's only been a tradition since then that every bill gets a hearing. Before that, there were gazillions of bills that just sat around without even getting a hearing, even a sponsorship hearing. So
I believe there's a House rule. I looked this up.
There might be a rule.
at some point in time last year, if it's introduced by a certain point in time, mm-hmm. it must have one hearing.
Yeah.
So
that's relatively new concept. Let's talk about term limits, legislative term limits. There's been a poll out there that shows that Ohioans are like, yeah, all right, we can extend them. Right now, what are they now, and what are people up for extending them to? Who knows?
Well, right now the House is limited to the House serves four-year the House members serve 2-year terms. They could do, I think, a total of eight in each.
8 years, so four
eight
terms.
And eight. In the Senate and the House, it's 8 years total. And they can bounce back and forth between chambers without, and then they reset their term limit clock. The Ohio voters voted in term limits in 1992, and the University of Akron Bliss Institute did a poll last week, I think. They're going to pass along their information to the Constitutional Modernization Commission, which is kind of studying a lot of different changes. The poll is sort of middling, 70% of the respondents said, yeah, they're happy with 8-year term limits. And then when they were asked, well, how about 12-year term limits? 57% said, yeah, we'd be okay with that. 57% say that term limits have given Ohio good government, while 30% disagree. This tells me that most people don't really care too much about term limits these days.
Although I don't think that you could get something through that would eliminate the term limits. I think that that's pretty ingrained into.
No, but I think the first step to eliminating them would be to extend them.
To lengthen them.
And then maybe extend them again. And then
finally, they're so far extended
term.
That.
Right.
And lawmakers, are they supportive? Is this something they care about?
Well, I think they would like to keep their jobs a little bit longer if they could. I don't know. It's kind of the term limits are kind of a mixed bag. The people who are interested in them and do have feelings about them, some are think that it's absolutely necessary that we should get fresh blood in and just keep things from becoming too political by having new people come in. But then you've got others saying, well, because we have this churn, we don't have the institutional knowledge that we used to have, and we're making mistakes that we already made in the past. And if we had some people here who'd been there then, they could warn us of that. And also, by having all these fresh faces here, and they know they only have maybe 2 to 8 years in this chamber, they're gonna just try and get as much legislation passed as they want to in their short period of time, instead of thinking long term into what do I want to do for Ohio over the course of my entire career.
What are the predictions with term limits? Would that there would be more women and minorities because of the churn? There would be more women and minorities, running for office, getting elected to office. But that has not been the case.
No, I think it's I think in the House it's about 28%, and it's been around that for at least the last 10 years.
Women, you mean?
Yeah,
and
women.
I think. I'm pretty sure that there are 17, maybe 18 African Americans, for instance, in the entire General Assembly, which is
much less than there used to be.
132 people.
Yeah. So,
that didn't come to pass.
That
has not pan out, yeah.
Nope.
I do think that there's sort of a steep learning curve to being a legislator. And I think probably about the time when they kind of get their footing, maybe 6 years in or so, they've been through a couple budgets. Then, it's almost time to go home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think about the way that they pick leadership positions, right? So perhaps by the time someone is ready to be Speaker of the House, for instance, they've had 2 terms, maybe 3. And if they've had 3, then they're only going to be Speaker for 2 years and then get out.
And Bill Batchelder, Speaker now, doesn't count because he served in the legislature for a long time before he
took a break
and then came back. So he does bring a lot of institutional memory.
Right. He was swept out when term limits took effect. And then he came back and he's on his 38th year.
Because, by the way, I still recognize a lot of people in the legislature.
Right. And they're the ones with the institutional knowledge.
Yeah. They switch back and forth. Mm-hmm. Well, Laura Bischoff, Chrissy Thompson, and Jackie Borchardt, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.